This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dashran Johan. For the last 2 weeks of the year, we're going to be revisiting some of the best discussions we've had throughout the year. On this edition of Best of Beyond the Ballot Box 2021, we'll be looking at democracy in Malaysia and the power of the people. Now, we often talk about the historic moment that was GE14 and how we as a nation toppled a coalition, Barisan Nasional, that have been at the helm of our government for more than 60 years. Question is, how much did we actually change? Here's a snippet of a conversation I had with Dr. Sharifah Monira Alatas, Senior Lecturer at the School of History, Politics and Strategic Studies at University Kebangsaan, Malaysia.
What seems like a major change, actually it wasn't major. Yes, it was a change. We only had a change of guard. And I think we've got to get it into our minds that what happened in GE14, yes, it was a change. It was a change in who our political masters are, but it was part of the process of elections. But a major change to say, I think maybe we will discuss this later, to say that we had a regime change, I think that's totally erroneous. Now, the fundamental dynamics of leadership basically remain the same. And I see it as what these dynamics are. It has been constantly elite bickering among elderly and seasoned politicians. And that's what we are seeing today in 2021. The younger few who were either professionals or from civil society who had made it politically, they were drowned out, or some of them developed similar crony mentalities once they got into office. So in my mind, there was no major change. But having said that, how was change possible? I can't answer this question without going back to our education system, which has molded our current younger generation who are going to be our future leaders. We do have a cohort of youth among the electorate, as well as young MPs then, just after GE14. Mm-hmm. Now, many were frustrated with the lack of values in our politics. For example, talk about party hopping, flimsy allegiance to political parties, disloyalty shown to party leaders, and then the big issue of using race and religion to rile up voter sentiments. Now, this has been the usual practice. And these are the same complaints we are hearing now in 2021. We've been hearing it pre-GE14, GE13, and previous GEs, and now it is the same narrative. So when I mentioned the education system earlier, I mean in particular two particular subjects, actually.
Okay.
One is politika and moral, and the other is history. Now, in pendidikan moral, for instance, the Ruku Negara is taught. Emphasis is on loyalty, charity towards marginalized groups, acceptance of differences. However, teachers mention these values as a list of 5 points in the Ruku Negara, and it's for students to memorize.
Yeah.
So the youth, who are these students, they become uninterested, they get bored. And also the political indoctrination through the study of the Ruku Negara. For instance, the 5 points, which are faith to God, loyalty to king and country, respect for the rule of law, and then there's morals and good behavior. And the last one is about the upholding the constitution. Okay, it's packaged around the deeper agenda of political indoctrination. And what do I mean by this? For instance, respect and loyalty, it's satya, is taught to as, it's taught as respect and loyalty to leaders, king and country. And then rule of law is minimized. then on topics of self-development, national growth or progress, there's the element of gratitude, berterima kasih, that is taught, and students are taught to be proud of their national leaders for this development. So right. Be grateful to your national leaders. It's not taught as a general be grateful for your fellow citizens, or you know, it's projected at leadership.
Feudalism is indoctrinated, you know, within our education system.
Yes, it's an indoctrination to revere your leaders, no matter what. And then the last point about trustworthiness, that's also taught in school in Pendidikan Moral. Amanah. It's slogans, government slogans are used to describe what trustworthiness is. And it's Bersih Cakap and Amanah. And we know that these are slogans used by previous political parties. So I don't know if this is part of the... It is a part of the indoctrination process. It's very superficial and it's rhetorical. I have one more thing to say about the history part. Now, in history, Sejarah Melayu is taught, and you know, Malacca is revered as the golden age of Malaysian history. The idea is to inculcate a social agenda, a continuation from Sejarah Melayu era, as if you will, the idea of absolute loyalty to the ruler and a social contract between ruler and subject. And this was embodied in the Sejarah Melayu text. Yet, within the text, you have subjects of corruption, human rights, civic duties, upholding the rule of law, but also oppression of leadership. You know, the oppression of leadership aspects of Sejarah Melayu are ignored.
You're right. So
I don't see how the teaching of history is going to teach the students about what problems we are facing today and how to react against them.
That was a snippet from the episode titled Did We Actually Change Anything After GE14? With Dr. Sharifah Munira Alatas, who's a senior lecturer in the School of History, Politics and Strategic Studies at UKM. Listening to Dr. Sharifah reminded me of a similar conversation I had with Arvind Kadirchelvan. He's the head of Science and Technology Bureau at Parti Socialist Malaysia Youth, where we discussed the problem with parliamentary democracy in Malaysia and whether the masses actually have power within the framework of our current electoral system. You mentioned in the article that parliamentary democracy, as practiced in a lot of countries, including here in Malaysia, merely showcases progressivity while letting ethno-fascists and neoliberals thrive. What do you mean by this?
Yeah, those are quite big words.
I have no idea what they mean.
I was in a particularly foul mood when I was writing that, but I'll explain. So basically, what I mean by ethno-fascists is people... essentially racists. So we have people who use race, religion, this kind of like identity politics to put one community over another and thrive off of that kind of superiority complex. Things like white supremacists in Europe or America as the basis of their political agenda, essentially. So those are the ethno-fascists.
Right.
The second part is neoliberals. So neoliberals are people who are essentially socially liberal and fiscally conservative is their word, basically.
Right.
So essentially they are for the market, they are okay with the capitalistic system, but they form a coalition based on social reforms, things like, we need to have less racism or we need to fight against religious supremacy, stuff like that, essentially. But throughout the world, we can see most governments are either one or the other, either the neoliberals or the extreme right. So why is this so? The reality is because both do not stand in the way of global capitalism. So what I mean by global capitalism is let's say your handphone, right? It's made by some big business, let's say Apple makes it in America, right? But their supply chain is throughout the global south.
That's right.
They do this to drive down the costs of components so that they can sell their phones at whatever price they want to sell, but at a high margin of profit, essentially. So this is the global system that exists in the world. And both the neoliberals, because they support the market, because they support how it is, and the ethno-fascists, because they find that this disempowerment of the common man is problematic, but they tack onto that things like, you are only poor because of immigrants. You are only poor because this race or this religion is profiting off of you, and that is what is disempowering you. So the neoliberals openly support a market that disempowers the masses. The ethno-fascists trick the masses into thinking this is because of external factors rather than the system itself.
Right.
So at the end of the day, at the core, the global capitalist system is preserved by both sides. That's why both of them are so prevalent in the world today. So, for example, we have neoliberals like Pakatan, who are pro-market. We have ethno-fascists like Fas and Amno, who are so like, no, the Malay Muslims have been disempowered. We have so little money. And that is true. A lot of Malays actually have very little money. But is that because of the Chinese taking away their wealth, or is it because the system pulls away their wealth into the billionaires, who, by the way, in 2020, their wealth grew by 14%, even when the Malaysian, economy shrunk by 5.6%. That is the main problem, but that is not what got highlighted by both sides. It is highlighted by Marxists like us, but that is why almost every Marxist country in the world, especially in South America, has been destroyed by U.S. intervention. That is a reason why these things exist.
Right. So now, one thing you also mentioned in your article is, you know, and you've brought up throughout this discussion is, you know, empowering people from the ground up. So talk to me about the importance of going down to the grassroots, organizing and mobilizing.
Okay. So there are many, many advantages or importances why we must do this. So I'm just going to go through it one by one.
Okay.
One is, of course, to the local community themselves, they need to understand what their power is. The common man is so alienated. We call capitalism as alienating and atomizing system, that because it focuses on keeping the individual as an individual. And if they start to form organizations and associations, they will understand that their voice and their needs can be amplified by sticking with the people that are similarly affected. So this is the big importance of organizing on the ground, to make people realize that actually, if they band together with people that are like them and ask for something and show that they are a functioning unit to bring forth certain needs that they list out, they can be a very powerful force. That's what we do at BSM. We try to help people organize around their issues. So, for example, if plantation workers are losing their land because their land has been sold to a developer, we organize all of the people in that area who are affected. We send a letter to the authority saying this is not on, we don't like this. Of course, the authorities will say it's out of our hand, blah, blah, blah. But given enough political pressure, reforms can happen in the sense that people there can get alternative housing, for example. This is educating the masses that their voices can be amplified by sticking together. That is one. That is one of the most important things to help people solve their problems by themselves. Secondly, in the bigger political system, we must realize that only when the common man realizes his power and forms together to form associations and unions, can they demand for certain political, matters to be done.
Right.
As I said before, forming the people's councils in a residential area, going up to the very top, all of this requires people to realize the worth of organizing and getting together. In this system where it takes that realization, that education away from the people, we must have organizers like PSM, like so many other of our NGO comrades, to come together and educate the masses on this. At the end of the day, the common man must take power and they must own the means of production. And for this, in a system designed to disempower the common man, designed to keep him separate from his own people, there must be people like us to organize them.
That was a clip from an episode titled The Problem with Parliamentary Democracy, featuring Arvind Kadir Chelvan, Head of Science and Technology Bureau at Party Socialist Malaysia Youth. All right, we do need to go for a quick break now. When we come back, we will continue reflecting on the best of Beyond the Ballot Box in 2021. Keep it here on PFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and today we are having a listen to the best conversations we had throughout the year on democracy and power of the people. Speaking of, I spoke with Kira Yusri, who's the co-founder of Undi 18, and Sharon Raj, Central Committee of Party Socialist Malaysia, on the importance of protests and how we can change the mindset of the rakyat so that we know that we have the power to shape the country in our image, not the government or the elites. Here's a little bit of that conversation.
Yeah, I think this is where constitutional literacy is extremely important. I think the freedom to assembly, falls, is a right given to us under the federal constitution. But if you ask many people, they seem to think every single protest, whether it's during a pandemic or not, is a crime. So I think we really lack. By and large, I think we lack the literacy to understand, and I guess the capacity to understand and internalize our federal constitution. And with that not in place, you don't understand what are your rights and what are the privileges given to you as a citizen of this country, right? And then I think political literacy is also one thing that's clearly lacking. Although I have to admit that ever since Undi 18 and also 2018 elections happen, there is a bigger desire and there is a bigger importance placed into political education. So the question will just now fall into, like, do we have enough time? And also, what is a level, of like what is enough? What is enough political education for people, for us to think, okay, we can sort of safely assume that people can speak up and things like that. So I think progress is always slow, right? And reforms will take time. And I am on the opinion that we cannot help but have to be patient when we push for these reforms. Because while it's easy to be angry and it's easy to demand for issues, sometimes legislation change can happen first before society believes in a change. Right. So, in example, Undi 18, 2 years ago, the challenge was to convince the mass population that Undi 18 makes sense. 2 years later, people now have accepted Undi 18, but suddenly politicians have trouble with it because now they see the potential and the impact it can bring on their political careers. So it's always going to be a challenge. It's always going to be a struggle to get people to understand reforms. And this is not a problem. This is not an issue unique only to Malaysia. Right. It's a very common issue that activists face all around the world. So I think it's the two key areas is that, for me, that we need to invest in the young. And what I mean by investing is not just telling everyone to go protest or not telling everyone to join a political party, but one is to understand our constitution, internalize it, understanding what are the rights that we have underneath the very important document. And then secondly, getting them to question the situation and the environment around them, questioning why we don't have better roads, why we don't have better education, why we still don't have the laptops promised to us by the government, mm-hmm. why do we still not given the right to vote? I think these are the questions that we need to encourage young people to ask themselves. And this is what I believe action will follow naturally, because when people ask questions, they get angry. And when they get angry, they take action.
A lot of people think that the protest is actually not a Malaysian culture. But if you look historically, when you look at the earlier post-independence or even at the pre-independence for that matter, there were millions of people were involved in protests. And one of the very important will be Hartal 1948, where in Malaya, we collapsed the entire British economy. We just shut it down for a whole day. Even the post-independence, when then UMNO could not actually solve inequality, the major labor movement, some of it is known as like Brickfield Strike and so on, they were repetitive. At one point of time in Malaysia, right after the independence, there were nearly one protest every week. One labor protest every week. There were student protests. It was amazing, colorful, this and that. And it cripple the right wing, the aristocracy politics in Malaysia. And a lot of reforms came out of it. Some of it is free education. Some of it was public healthcare and all of this. So we actually got it by forcing the hands of the politicians. But what happened over the last, between 1980 to 2000, which we call during the earlier period of Mahathirism, is a brutal attack on the democracy, a brutal attack, things like Ops Lalang, the overuse of ISA and so on. Okay? It was really, really brutal. It feared people. And then debts were tied to people, you know, things like housing loan, PTPT, yeah, and all of this. So it made people more individualistic. And we eventually lost it. So when you look at our grandparents' generation, they were amazing, empowered people. But then our parents' generation was suppressed so bad. But when you look at now the younger people being a bit more educated, being a bit more self-aware, they are actually coming forward. And one thing that we could actually do to actually improvise is actually to let people know their rights, okay? Human rights is birthright and the Constitution protects it, okay? Some people say the Constitution gives it. No, actually the Constitution protects it. It's our birthright. You can't take it away. So we need to let them know. I would like to share a small story. Yeah? A few years ago, the University of Technology Malaysia from the campus Kuala Lumpur, they had issues of high fees and they have reached out for PSM for support. We went in and we tried to work with them. We organized them and we told them to do a protest. Obviously, they were very scared. It was like a protest. Mm. We got permission from the police, this and that. And PSM, we went in, we did training for the students, telling that you do not ask permission from the police to do a public assembly. You notify them. Mm. Okay? And we actually had to thank some of our predecessors, activists in the last 2 decades. Some of them are not alive today, but it was them who opened up the democratic space. They fought for this democracy space. And when you tell the students that you just notify and the police has to give you security, they have to give you support. And this empowers them to come forward. And when that group enlarges, more people come forward. Sometimes we are very scared when you start fighting alone, but when the group is bigger, we become more empowered. So we need to organize people. We need to tell them this is your right and we need to claim that democratic space and no one can take your democracy right. It is your birthright. The only birthright every human has is their right to speak, their right to assemble, right for freedom of expression. And that is the founding fabric of our society, different ideas, this and stuff. And this needs to be reinforced properly. It's not only in the youngsters, it needs to be told to our parents' generation because actually if comparatively in the 60 years since the founding of this federation, it seems that our parents' generation are the most suppressed, the most timid. But our grandparents' generation have had a more vibrant culture, which has been systematically taken out from the history book. They don't want to discuss about it because it empowers people to come forward. Yeah. So that has to be reinstated. I think we should let people learn the history. And the younger generation has a responsibility to educate the masses. As the younger generation, which is more empowered, it is our responsibility to empower others, right? Because we cannot move individually. As a society, we must move together.
That was a snippet from the episode titled People, Protest, Power with Kira Yusri, co-founder of Undi 18, and Sharon Raj, Central Committee of Parti Socialist Malaysia. Finally, we can't discuss the people's power in 2021 without touching on the lawan protest that took place at Masjid Jame, where around 2,000 young people gathered and marched to the entrance of Dataran Merdeka, calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin. A few days before the protest, I once again caught up with Kira Yusri, one of the organizers of the protest.
I think, one thing is that, you know, protesting is a form of freedom of expression here in Malaysia. Mm-hmm. And I think when it comes to the pandemic, we have to be very creative in how do we express our opinions and our voices. And I think the car convoy was an idea. You know, it's not new, right? I mean, people overseas have done it before. And then we thought that, you know, it's a great way to maintain safety and social distancing because everyone is within your own car. You know, and then on our side, you know, the secretariat made a notice to make sure that only 2 person per car as per SOP. And we could see that nationwide people are picking it up and, you know, they were just driving in their own cars, either, you know, hanging a black flag or just putting a black T-shirt attached to the window. Because the high traction shows that, you know, people want to keep speaking up, you know. And I think over the past few months, we've done various forms of Black Flags protests. I think from people just posting Black Flags on, you know, in social media, hanging outside their houses. And then you see people on Twitter and Instagram also wearing black to vaccinations, you know, just to make a point. So I think, you know, the people are looking for avenues to just speak up. And I think for civil society, we're looking for how do we create this platform so that people can, you know, have that space to vent their frustrations.
When we look at these protests, right, I mean, a protest isn't there to just show sort of discontent with someone or something or you know, the establishment. Usually, you know, you are demanding something as well. So what were the demands made during these protests?
I think the protests have made consistently a few demands. The first one being demanding that the Prime Minister, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, to step down and so was the entire cabinet. Second one is to both end the emergency and reopen Parliament to, you know, fully, not what we have now, which is a presentation, and then they discuss about it. And then last but not least is having a full moratorium with no exceptions. I think what we have now is not a moratorium, it's more of a loan restructure, with even Bank Negara coming out saying that, you know, it's not actually what people understand it as. It's clear that the government is not putting in mechanisms or methods to support the people. And that's clearly by how, you know, they forced everyone to go into a movement control order for the past, what, 2-3 months. And instead of having our numbers going down as they promised it would be, it has ballooned and, you know, increased exponentially to, I think today, the past few days, it has been about, you know, between 15 to 17,000 cases per day. So I think all of this just, it bubbles up into a lot of anger and frustration because it's not just about getting sick or you know, losing your lives or having your loved ones dying without being able to be by their side. But it's also the economic harm that that this pandemic has brought through with the lockdowns, with the uncertain SOPs. We have, you know, companies, small businesses closing up. My favorite Kopitiam Dasharan in Masjid Jami has closed.
Oh, no.
You know, Friday is the last day. So please go support these aunties called Sin Hai Hao. You know, these aunties are closing up their shop because, you know, they can't survive anymore because of the lockdown. And, you know, and even if you install a lockdown, you need to also pump out cash to the people. So I think just, you know, based on all of these gaps that that the government has created, you know, the people just has had enough lah.
Now, another argument I've heard from some, you know, whether it's people on, perhaps people who are pro-government, perhaps people within the government, or maybe just cyber troopers on social media, is that, you know, these protests, whether it's the black flags, raising black flags in general, or, you know, the convoy protests and what you guys have organized and what y'all are planning to carry out this Saturday, these are anti-government propaganda or, you know, pro-opposition movements and things like that. How do you respond to this?
That's a very interesting question, Dasha. I think for people who say this is a pro-opposition protest and activity, I think it's very clear. You can see that no politician has talked about the protest this weekend, not even opposition. And also, again, disappointingly, there are not many politicians on either side talking about the clampdown that has happening on young activists for the past few days. And I think the answer to that is that I don't think the people that are going on the protests are specifically pro-opposition or anti-government in that extent, right? But what is clear is that everyone is saying that this administration can do better. We deserve good governance, we deserve transparency, we deserve a better management of this pandemic, we deserve more information, more data about vaccination numbers and the process to procure them. And I think those are just very simple demands that we're asking from no matter who is in the government. So I think by calling out the failures of this administration, it does not mean that, you know, we are automatically voting for an entirely different party or coalition. But the thing is, people are articulating their dissatisfaction on the situation, and they're asking for people. They're asking for something. They're asking for a change, and they will not stop and they will not rest until that change happens.
Now, Kira, as we wrap up this conversation, right? You know, there might be perhaps listeners who who may be interested in engaging with the protests, but they may be afraid reading the reports that have come out in recent days, recent weeks, about how many young activists are getting called up. What would you tell them?
I would just tell people, you know, this year is my first year of me joining a protest, despite being a youth advocate for the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think the situation has become so bad that we don't have any other options to voice out about what's happening, you know, voicing out about the death, about the people getting sick. So while there are always concerns from in joining a protest, I think the organizers will try their best to make sure that it's safe. They've contacted legal teams. They've making sure that, you know, logistics wise, we're able to provide sufficient protection to everyone. I think people need to understand that we're at a point of no return, whereby we don't see any other platforms that where we can genuinely be heard. You know, I mean, I would just ask people, like, you know, how many more tweets can we send? How many more Clubhouse sessions can we sit in? How many more press statements can we co-sign? You know, I think they come to a point where, like, action is needed, and the action has to come from the people, and not waiting, and not, we're not, you know, we shouldn't be just waiting for politicians to make that change.
There was a clip from the episode titled #Lawan, Peaceful Protest to be Held at Dataran Merdeka on 31 July. With Kira Yusri, she's the co-founder of Undi 18 and one of the key figures of Secretariat Solidarity Rakyat, who are the organizers of the protests. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. If you'd like to check out the full episodes from any of these shows highlighted, they're all available on podcast. You can find them on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. Just search Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.